were Canadian citizens detained upon arrival at the Canadian airport based on quote-unquote faulty beliefs around Russia and Ukraine? How is the national broadcaster, the CBC, guilty of collaborating with the shenanigans of the Canadian Security Intelligence Service? Are concerns to intellectual freedom expressing themselves all the way to students with a quote-unquote unaccepted foreign policy point of view? How much further do we have to go before we slide into the democratic vision of Nazi land? This week on the Global Research News Hour, concerns are starting to be raised about more and more journalists, activists, and even scholars who are having their lives disrupted in the wake of detentions, arrests, and even outright suppression of rights as the cancer of anti-terrorism laws grows to the point of targeting almost anyone who voices concerns, as we have on the show, about the NATO-instigated Ukraine war, opposition to the genocidal campaign waged by Israel, and more. The show features an array of guests with dissenting views on foreign policy in Canada and abroad facing such measures and some analysis of what can be done to reverse this trend. Conversations with journalists Ava Bartlett and Vanessa Bealey, and with academics Tamara Lawrence, Radhika Desai, and Kevin McKay. On this week's program, first they came for the journalists and the academics, the sun now setting on democracy as we know it. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of October 18th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Ininu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The settlers who came to these shores received the assets of the land while betraying the promises and trusts forged with the indigenous people who were here first. Today's descendants must strive to recognize the injustices by which their fortune today was realized and pursue reparations so that respect between the two partners may be realized. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. The International Crisis Summit descended on Tokyo last week to warn about the new quote-unquote replicon, self-amplifying mRNA vaccines that are about to be unleashed like a third atomic bomb upon the population of Japan. James Corbett was there to cover the proceedings, to document the speeches, to participate in a massive rally in the heart of Tokyo against this dangerous new medical intervention, and to lecture sitting members of the Japanese Diet about his bodily sovereignty. That comes from the introduction to a film under the headline video, Japan Rising, the Tokyo International Crisis Summit, the new quote-unquote replicon, self-amplifying mRNA vaccines, posted October 17th, originally published at The Corbett Report. Bayer has a view of what agriculture should look like and is gaining increasing control of farmers in various countries in terms of having a direct influence on how they farm and what inputs they use. Its digital platforms are intended to be one-stop shops for carbon credits, seeds, pesticides, and fertilizers, and agronomic advice, all supplied by the company which gets the added benefit of control over the agronomic and financial data harvested from farms. As for carbon credits, the nonprofit Grain argues that, like digital platforms per se, carbon trading is about consolidating control within the food system and is certainly not about sequestering carbon. So what does Wybush mean when he talks about modernization of a backward agriculture in India? All of what is set out above and more. That comes from the article, Bears, quote-unquote, backward claim, a bid to reap control of Indian agriculture, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted October 17th. What is their secret in being able to do what no other nation has done that is not part of the official Western hegemony? This is the question addressed by A.B. Abrams in his most recent book. The answer, of course, is complex, but includes North Korea's own decision to acquire nuclear weapons and missiles to attack the American homeland. It's also a question that hit the front page headlines when President Donald Trump visited North Korea and engaged with its leader, Chairman Kim Jong-un, and became the first U.S. chief executive to say anything about North Korea other than insults. Under the Biden administration, North Korea returned to the crosshairs, though with its support of Russia in Ukraine and the creation of a new multipolar world led by Russia and China, a page may have been turned, with matters still being far from settled. That comes from the article, Surviving the Unipolar Era, North Korea's 35-year standoff with the United States, a review of A.B. Abrams' new book, by Richard C. Cook, posted October 17th, originally published on the author's Substack. Irrespective of the crimes these inmates were sentenced for by the courts, the level of injustice embedded in the judicial system is a clear reflection of the power dynamics within society as a whole. Elements within the ruling class have committed far greater crimes against people inside the U.S. and abroad while never facing prosecution, let alone capital punishment. Just within the last 60 years, wars of occupation, forced removals, and genocide have and are still occurring. Those who have systematically denied the rights of millions to due process and to live a decent life, free of impoverishment, racial profiling, and all forms of oppression and exploitation, can by no means sit in judgment against anyone from the working class and poor. Those who are utilizing street crime as a rationale for mass incarceration of the largely black, brown, and poor masses should be more concerned about the abolition of inequality and national oppression rather than seeking to impose social control. That comes from the article Race, Class, and the Death Penalty in the United States by Abiyomi Azikiwe, posted October 17th.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
Kit Clarenberg, Richard Medhurst, Craig Murray, and Vanessa Beely were just a few individuals detained and subjected to intense interrogation at airports in the UK by the authorities. And they are not alone. Two Canadian individuals, Ava Bartlett and Tamara Lawrence, were added to the list of people of interest. Global Research NewsHour took the time to reach out to them and get their story. Ava Bartlett is an award-winning independent journalist based currently in Moscow. Tamara Lawrence is a peace activist and PhD student at the Balsillie School of International Relations at the University of Waterloo.
I had not been back to Canada for 4 years, mainly because of the COVID policies for the first 2 years since 2020 when I left Canada. And then because, since 2019, I've been on the Ukrainian kill list, Miradvorets. And in 2022, CBC did a smear on my journalism, which is throughout 2022 was from the Donbass under Ukrainian fire with most of the time Western weapons. And for my crime of doing journalism from the Donbass and how Ukraine's bombings have brutalized civilians there, The CBC decided to smear me, but the interesting thing is they drew from the kill list, Mirat Vorest's entry on me. So CBC was very aware of the fact that a Canadian journalist is on a Ukrainian kill list, but they did not address it. They used that information to smear me. And so then I became concerned if I were to come back to Canada after that, they have just alerted Ukrainian nationalists in Canada of my existence, and then it could be very dangerous for me. However, that said, by February this year, I decided I would risk it because I had not seen my elderly mother for quite a while, 4 years. And so I went back to Canada and I was met at Toronto's Pearson Airport. I went to the passport control. It seemed like they were going to stamp me out, but then I was told to go step aside and I was taken, had my suitcase, my purse, everything that I was carrying with me searched item by item. The man doing it was nice enough. And hostile. He asked me a lot of questions, trying to garner as much information from me about who I am, what I do, where I've been. And after, I don't remember, a 20, 30 minute search, then he said, CSIS would like to talk to you. It's voluntary, but will you talk to them? And I'm aware of CSIS visiting people's homes like that of Ken Stone. And I did not want my brothers exposed to that. So I said, yes, I will talk to him for a short period. We ended up speaking for about 20 minutes, during which time, I don't remember verbatim his questions, but he started by trying to make himself likable to me by saying that he had also lived in Gaza. As it turned out, he lived there when the illegal Jewish colonists were there. So he was part of the occupation in whatever he was doing there. But then he went on to ask me the nature of my journalism, who I knew in Russia. He named a specific person who I did know and was trying to find out information when I'd last seen him and where. And I told him, I'm not going to tell you that information. And then he went on to basically say, this is not verbatim, basically ask me if I'm taking directives from the Kremlin in my journalism. And I replied to him, my journalism is based on what I see and hear on the ground under Ukrainian shelling. And then I write about it. Nobody tells me what to write. So he did, I didn't get Tamara's as hostile treatment. He did tell me that CSIS is there to protect me, which I bit my tongue because quite honestly, I wanted to see my mother. He came back to me when I was exiting Canada roughly 2 weeks later, when I was just ready to board my flight. And he repeated that CSIS was there to protect me, to which I replied, Canada is literally arming Nazis in Ukraine who are bombing civilians in Donbass. And I have been there under the bombs. Canada is not there to protect me.
The article that had been written about you that smeared you. It said that you'd been writing for RT. And that is correct.
Well, I have written for RT since 2013 when I still lived in Gaza. It was the only major outlet that would allow me to write on what I was seeing under Israeli bombs and other torture policies against Palestinians. And RT was the only big platform that would allow me to write without any sort of censorship what I was seeing, what Palestinians were enduring. And so over the years since then, I've contributed op-eds pretty randomly, sometimes a couple times a year or more, I don't remember. And more frequently in recent years, because again, it's grown to be a massive platform. And the way it works is I pitch, they say yes or no, whether it's newsworthy or not, and nobody tells me what to write. So the implication that just because it's published on a Russian media platform, therefore it's propaganda is just, it's a ludicrous accusation that the West is using, along with these intimidation tactics of arresting and intimidating journalists. They're using that to try to silence unpopular narratives. In other words, narratives that are contrary to their lies, frankly, and narratives that are about actually ending wars and bringing peace.
Hmm. Tamara, you got the same kind of treatment earlier this month. You want to elaborate?
Yes, so I would like to begin by saying that I went to Russia from September 16th to October 2nd. I was invited to attend the Eurasian Women's Forum. This was a big gathering of women, almost 2,000 from 126 countries in St. Petersburg. I also attended the BRICS Women's Meeting, again, with thousands of women. And I also attended a peace conference in St. Petersburg on peace, nature, and cooperation in the Arctic and Baltic regions. So I, was going to Russia on a peace mission. And I was also going in the spirit of people-to-people diplomacy. I wanted to learn more about the country. I was in St. Petersburg for a week, and then I was in Moscow for a week, and I scheduled meetings because I'm an academic. I also scheduled meetings with professors at other universities and had a number of really good exchanges with students and with professors. And so that's why I went to Russia. And on my way back, when I arrived at the Toronto International Airport, I went quickly through passport control, didn't have anything to declare. I got my passport, approved and going through passport control. And I was walking out of that area and there was another security guard. Usually the security guards just quickly have a look at your declaration form, but this one, took me aside and he asked me more questions about my travel itinerary. And then, he said, "Well, where are you coming from?" I said, "From Turkey." And he goes, "Where else have you been traveling, from today?" And I said, "Russia." And then he started asking me the questions. Why was I in Russia? He goes, "Well, that's very interesting." Started to ask me more questions. And then he wrote on my declaration, BIO, I think, border inspection. And when then I picked up my l luggage and, wanting to leave the airport to get back home because I hadn't been home in 2.5 weeks. He was this Canadian border services agent was there at the exit, and as I was trying to go through, he said, "No, you need to come with me." And so I went to another area of the airport that was a large securitized room. I was only the only one in that area, required to go through this secondary examination. So I was on a plane, with about 300 people coming from all over the region, all over the Middle East, Eastern Europe, and I'm the only one that's in this area being questioned by this border agent. And that's because I was in Russia. And so he asked me a lot of questions. I was there list, trying to answer questions, giving as minimal information as I could. But he also went through all of my belongings, just like he did with Eva, inspecting every single article and all of my bags. The thing that he was interested in was my No to NATO literature. And I had a couple of banners with me, and he, wanted to have me unfurl them and was looking at that. And then when he had gone through all of his questioning, examining all of my bags, he asked if he could have copies of my No to NATO literature. And then I was leaving that area, there was a CSIS agent waiting for me. And I don't recall them saying, "You don't need to answer the questions." I decided I would have an interview with CSIS. And one of the reasons why is because I follow CSIS actually on social media. And I know CSIS is lying about Canadian foreign policy, particularly this war in Ukraine. So I decided to try to hardest the interview as best as I could to say that, I really objected to CSIS lying to Canadians about Russia and about the war in Ukraine, and that the CSIS is really a threat to to Canadian security, by not being honest and by not being, helping to end this war in Ukraine. That's a nuclear, risk for all of us. He also was interested in, why I was going to Russia, what my intentions were, who I was talking to, my opposition to NATO. He kept saying that, Canada needs to maintain a friendly relationship with the United States because our economy depends on it. And things like this. The most troubling thing was that, he did say to me that that CSIS had been following me, surveilling me for a long time, and that, I was well known by CSIS, and that there are agents that are covering all regions of Canada, and he's the agent that is overseeing southwestern Ontario, and he's been following my activities. So it's very troubling. He's, why is CSIS wasting time on peace activists instead of spending time and helping to end wars and build peace with all countries.
I'm wondering about the larger context, because I mean, I don't think CSIS is acting alone. They're coordinating with other groups, warning us of disinformation from Putin propagandists. And I mean, could you inform us more of what you know of these groups and individuals who warn us of Kremlin trolls like yourself?
Well, this is one of the things that I raised with the CSIS agent, is I said that Canadian intelligence services are not operating alone. Canada operates as part of the Five Eyes Alliance, you know, with dominated by the United States intelligence services, the UK, Australia, and New Zealand. And what CSIS is sharing on social media are the same things that the CIA in the United States is sharing on social media too. So they are trying to control the narrative about this war in Ukraine. They're lying to the Canadian public about what is going on. So for instance, you know, I brought copies of access to information documents that I have, you know, to Russia, you know, to show, for instance, in a meeting that I had with the Canadian embassy in Moscow, that definitively the Canadian military has been training and arming neo-Nazi militias in Ukraine, and they've known it for, you know, for years. So I have these records from inside the Department of National Defense that shows that our military, you know, knew that these groups that they were training under Operation Unifier had Nazi ideology, but we continued to support them and train them for years. You know, these are the groups that were shooting and shelling into the Donbass with our weapons. And so, you know, I have these documents. I'm showing, you know, the diplomats in Moscow. And then this is what I showed the CSIS agent. So I put the question to him directly. Why is Canada, you know, arming and training neo-Nazis in Ukraine? And then why are you lying about it on social media, saying that we're not doing it? It's CSIS that is deceiving the Canadian public. And this is what is so troubling. Canadians should be outraged, and there should be a national inquiry into this.
Ava, would you like to comment on this as well? And also you could bring in the fact that you yourself are, you know, in the sights of the Ukrainian kill list. And you know, how is that, you know, all coordinate to CSIS, you know, web of influence, if you will?
This Mir Vorets is not unique to Ukraine, and it is hosted on various servers, including Western servers. The fact that CBC was made aware, I refer to CBC because CSIS would have known that CBC did this Mir, because like Tamara said, if they are following her, and they stopped me, then I can assume they're also following me in my activities. And I've been very outspoken about the CBC smear, not because my feelings were hurt, but because it was so disingenuous and dishonest. They took away from the importance of what I and colleagues are doing on the ground in Donbass, reporting on Ukraine's crimes against civilians. And instead, they tried to depict me as a crazy person, Russian disinformation agent type of thing. And that's what this as I might have said earlier, this policy of harassment against journalists and activists, and also this Mirotvorets kill list. But by the way, the irony is Mirotvorets means peacemaker in Ukrainian. But that's what this list is about. It's about silencing dissent. But it is a real kill list. As much as people try to debate otherwise, when people are killed or die of suspicious means, they are marked as liquidated on this list. So CBC was made aware of this. They did nothing to expose it. And CSIS would have to be aware of it. And also, they did nothing. In fact, presumably the same man that questioned Tamara was speaking with me and kept saying, you know, we're here to protect you, and asking about my activities, I said to him, are you aware of the CBC entry on me? You know, I'm of the opinion you're not here to protect me. And he feigned innocence and ignorance about the list and the threat it poses to journalists and activists and civilians around the world, and doing nothing. As Tamara pointed out, instead, for years, covertly or overtly even arming Nazis in Ukraine and whitewashing their crimes. So it does come back to, as we keep saying, to silencing any sort of dissenting voices, because they need to control the narrative. And frankly, they're failing at it. I mean, even prior to 2022, certain Canadian media were reporting on the presence of these neo-Nazi elements within the Ukrainian armed forces. After 2022, they ceased reporting on it, and they're trying to basically say anybody who points this out are crazy, and this is a figment of your imagination. So they're trying to basically erase history, because then justify arming Ukraine, and then they can vilify Russia as if nothing happened prior to 2022, and as if Azov and Idar don't exist.
Yeah, you only got a couple of minutes left. I was wondering if I could get each of you to comment on how we can extract ourselves, because it seems like things are getting worse. What can we do to protect, you know, ourselves, to protect yourselves? Because I mean, it's not just going to be you. I mean, eventually they'll climb the ladder and even go after people like me.
I would say the first step is being aware of your rights and what they are or are not entitled to do. So as I read, CISA is not entitled to go into your phone. They can ask you questions. I don't believe you're obligated to answer them. But again, the reason I went ahead and answered them is that I didn't want them to pay my family a visit. And I also would stress that, again, these are intimidation tactics. So inform yourself of your right. Get in touch with legal advice if you do think you're going to be in a position that where you will be interrogated and attempted to be intimidated. And be prepared to have legal advice back you if you actually need it. But absolutely don't back down, because this is what they want us to do, is to stop reporting and stop speaking out. Again, I stress, and I know Tamara probably will say something, that this is not about ourselves as individuals. This is about reporting on the truth and stopping the bloodshed that is solely, in my opinion, it's solely the responsibility of the West, because they fomented this war. Me, for example, reporting on the effects of Ukraine's bombing of Donbass with Western weapons usually could contribute to other people, of course, obviously reporting on it, not just myself. The awareness that this is happening, awareness amongst Western public, could contribute to actually stopping the war. But when they silence voices like ours, then there's maybe not an impetus from the Western audience to put any sort of pressure on their governments to stop funding Ukraine and bring about a peace talk with Russia so that that peace can reign again.
Yes, so CSIS is trying to use intimidation tactics, you know, in order to silence and suppress peace voices and peace activists. So the antidote to this is raising our voices even louder, is speaking up, is calling for peace and diplomacy. You know, this is why I went to Russia to engage in people-to-people diplomacy, and why I'm urging, you know, all Canadians to go to Russia to educate themselves, to find ways to build peace, and not just Russia, our other so-called enemies. If you look at CSIS's latest national report, it identifies, you know, China, Iran, North Korea as adversaries and threats to Canada. So, you know, these are other countries that we need to find ways to build peace with. And, you know, I just want to urge people to find, yeah, creative ways to engage in peacemaking, because we need to prevent a broader war with Russia, a broader war in the Middle East, and, you know, peace is just so essential.
Ava Bartlett, Tamara Lawrence, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll look forward to hearing from you again on these and other subjects related to peace and justice. So thank you very much.
Thanks very much for covering this.
We've been speaking with Ava Bartlett, a Canadian independent journalist and activist, and Tamara Lawrence of the Canadian Voice of Women for Peace.
When we come back, I will talk to three more individuals who've similarly expressed suppression on the grounds of supporting Russian or anti-Israel suppression. Vanessa Beely, an award-winning independent journalist now living in Damascus, Radhika Desai, professor of geopolitics at the University of Manitoba, and Kevin McKay, anthropology professor at Mohawk College of Applied Arts and Technology, will be up after a brief break.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
I will start with Professor McKay. Could you comment a little on the experiences that you have endured and witnessed in the last year or so?
Thank you. Yeah, I think like a lot of other folks in academia who are studying critical foreign policy, so they're looking at world events from a lens that is critical of Western interests, you know, Western colonialism, imperialism. We've all been, I think, experiencing a chill and pushback in various ways. At my institution, it has there's been a couple of campaigns to get me fired. I seem to have very, very poor luck using space on campus to hold any kind of critical event, and I'm trying to use legal means to push against that. So definitely been experiencing a lot of suppression, and then also encountering other folks who have been as well. And so I really think this is a national phenomenon that we're witnessing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I guess especially with the what's happening on campuses with students who are trying to embargo the against, you know, starting the embargoes against the genocide of Palestinians. Yeah.
Yeah, very much so. So we've seen it among students and faculty. You're right. There's really a concerted effort to crack down on any alternative narratives. And I think it speaks a lot to, as I'm sure other guests will speak to, the importance of establishment narratives in enabling things like the Palestinian genocide, enabling the proxy war in Ukraine. I think that, you know, obviously our governments, the military industrial complex, the other power centers, the only way they can do what they do is if there is, you know, profound misinformation and really skewed narratives out there in the public. And I think folks who are trying to push against that, you know, such as Vanessa Radica, you know, myself, other academics, are becoming targets simply because they can't let the truth come out.
Okay. Radhika Desai, I know that you travel pretty frequently as part of your job. You know, you've been to China many times, Russia, you've been, you know, all over the place. And you actually ask some of the guests to come here, convene them in conferences, have them speak to your students and so on. Something happened to you recently that's, as I understand it, it's never happened before. And you know, maybe you could enlighten us on what exactly happened. It was at an airport, correct?
Yeah, so I just want to say that actually the history of trying to suppress the alternative, suppress the truthful narratives, that at least the diverse views that we must put forward in order to have any proper debate, the suppression of that for me in my personal experience goes back a long way. I remember in 2014, when essentially Russia incorporated Crimea into its own territory, and Boris Kagarlitsky, who you will know is at the moment under arrest in Russia, at that time, he had held a conference. He's a good friend of mine and my husband, Alan Freeman's, and he had invited us to a conference in Yalta, in the Crimea. We had gone there. It was a conference of activists. As you know, when the original civil war started, there was a, you know, these people called them, they saw themselves as establishing these people's republics and so on. And so we had gone there, and there was another Canadian there, Roger Annis. And when we all came back, we decided to hold an event just to report on what we had done, because we had been talking to all the activists. The Odessa massacre had just taken place. So there were activists from all over essentially reporting on what had happened. And we, after coming back, we held a public meeting at the Ukrainian Labor Temple, which is a very well-known and beautiful venue here in Winnipeg. And we had essentially people who were also academics at the same university, but also their community allies, try to disrupt our meeting. A year or two later, we had an event on NATO. There were attempts to disrupt it. Every so often, there are people writing to my head of department or my dean saying this woman should not be working here, etc. But so far, thanks to the University of Manitoba, they have taken the position that Radhika has, as like all faculty members, has academic freedom. And I have written about Ukraine. I have edited a book about it. So it's not like I'm, you know, mouthing off about things I know nothing about. Then yes, you were mentioning, this was already in the background. And then last year, we were going to Valdai. It's essentially Russia's equivalent of the Council on Foreign Relations. If the Council on Foreign Relations of a big and important country invites you, you want to go because there are really interesting people there. And by the way, I should mention that the guests at Valdai don't just include, you know, sort of people from countries that are not Western. They include a lot of Western countries. There are people from France, from Germany, from the UK, from Italy, from all over Western Europe, etc. But anyway, so we were there, and before we got there, we actually were in China for a few days for a conference, and then we were going from China to Sochi and back, and then back from China to Winnipeg. And so while we were in China, we heard that Valdai had been sanctioned by the Canadian government. This immediately raised the question, should we go or not? Alan and I sat and we read the sanctions, like the law of the sanctions. We consulted informally, of course, a lot of friends, knowledgeable friends, including friends who were lawyers. And we decided on balance that the sanctions did not apply to us. We went. We returned. We spent a couple more days in China before returning to via Vancouver to Canada and to Winnipeg. And at Vancouver Airport, Alan and I were subject to a 3 hours long interrogation in which the customs officers were essentially on a fishing expedition, saying things like, do you know Valdai has been sanctioned? Why did you go to Valdai? Who did you meet? Blah, blah, and so on. And initially we thought, you know, we should cooperate. What have we got to hide? We can tell them everything that we do, etc. So we cooperated, but they kept pushing and being really aggressive and often insulting and all that. So then finally we decided, okay, we're not going to, you know, this is it. So I said, you know, you keep saying that Valdai has been sanctioned, but I have read the sanctions law. It does not apply to attending conference. Have you read the sanctions law? And this guy says, oh, there are two people there. Oh, we don't know anything about sanctions. We're just customs officers. I said, right. So I'm answering every last question you got about what is on my person, what's in my bags. But that, and I let you do your job as a customs officer, but I'm not answering a single other question about Valdai or anything that's none of your business. So then they tried to, they goaded me for another 15 minutes, but they finished with Alan by this time. They goaded me for another 15 minutes and then they gave up because I refused. I literally just stood there like this and I did not answer any question. You know, they would do stupid things like, don't put your hands in your pockets. Like, where have you heard that? You know, they just do anything to try to intimidate you, to discombobulate you, to make you feel like you are very insecure and you really have to fight back. But they were just on a fishing expedition. They got nothing. And I am going to Valdai again this year, and I will see what they do when I come back.
Oh, well, good for you. Of course, Alan, that's Alan Freeman, your partner, I assume. Vanessa Beely, you were confronted at Heathrow Airport almost 3 years ago, I believe. And I mean, you live in Damascus now, but you traveled to different centers from time to time. I noticed that you've really undercut Western state narratives, you know, particularly with regard to the white helmets in Syria, right? And maybe you may have run into difficulties, you know, just for that with, you know, getting into United States and Canada, but you know, as I understand it, it's nothing like what you went through at Heathrow Airport. And does it sound, what Radhika went through, does that sound similar to what you went through? Could you just, and this is like—
Yeah, very similar. But I mean, if you remember when I did the speaking tour in Canada, I think that was 2018 or 2019, I'm losing
2019,
track.
I think, yeah.
But if you remember, every single talk was boycotted and shut down. And we had to, in every city, find a last minute venue to do the talk. I mean, it was just extraordinary. And even in Winnipeg, by the way, I can't remember the university that stopped it, but crazy. Yeah. But anyway, so I came to live in Syria in 2019.
Yeah.
And then, of course, COVID hit and everyone was kind of pretty much isolated, couldn't go anywhere. And then I think it was at the end of 2022, I decided I would go back. My brother had had his first baby, so I wanted to go back for Christmas. And I'll never forget, so it was a flight coming in from Beirut. I'm probably the only British person on this flight. And I get off the plane and there's two plainclothes policemen standing there, one woman, one guy. And they basically presented themselves as the anti-terrorist squad, They demanded my passport, my mobile phone. And I remember that my first statement to them was, why are you arresting me? Why aren't you arresting the British government? They're responsible for the terrorism in Syria. I was so angry. I was so incensed, you know,
Radhika, you stood your ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And I refused to give the mobile phone. So they said, okay, if you don't, we'll arrest you. So I
You're a journalist
to hand
too,
it over. It? Yeah. So it was Section 7 of the Anti-Terrorist Act, which is effectively, as Radhika mentioned, it's a fishing expedition, right? And I was held for 6 hours, which is the maximum amount of time that they can hold you under this particular section. There is now another section that they're bringing into use where they can effectively arrest people without charging them and hold them, like Richard Medhurst and Sarah Wilkinson in the UK, for their anti-genocide views. I'm not even going to say pro-Palestinian because, you know, any human being should be against what Israel is doing to the Palestinians and now to the Lebanese, and of course for many years against Syria also. And so I was interrogated for this 6 hours. I had my DNA taken, I had my fingerprints taken, I was photographed like a criminal, you know, with your face against, you know, against the wall and you have to turn sideways. So it was a total criminalization process. It was a total intimidation harassment process. And The thing is, at the end of it, because I had also undergone, very much like Eva, about Eva Bartlett, 2 years of solid media pressure and attacks, not only media, but also from academic institutions where I was, going to speak and so on. But I found out at the end of the interview, so at the end of the 6 hours, that effectively the BBC had given the information to the terrorist squad. Why did I know this? Because of the questions that were being asked were related to a sting operation that was carried out against an academic that was part of the working group investigating the OPCW corruption and misreporting of the alleged chemical weapon attacks in Syria, particularly in 2018 in Douma in the eastern suburbs of Damascus. So it became very clear to me then that media outlets like the BBC and The Guardian and Channel 4 and all of these outlets that had been attacking me for 2 years were working in lockstep with the security agencies in the UK, who were then triggering the anti-terrorist police. And I wasn't investigated, by the way, about my Syria work so much, although that was a major part of the conversation. I was stopped on the basis that I was giving secret information to foreign intelligence agencies, primarily Russia. So, you know, and it was ridiculous. And to a degree, you know, I was pretty relaxed. I didn't have anything to hide. Everything I say is in the public domain anyway. And at the end of 6 hours, they did give me back my phone, which many people didn't have that advantage.
So, I mean, it's not as if they actually believe necessarily that you are this terrible person, that they're, it's like you say, a fishing expedition, and they're trying to, you know, get whatever they can, and to intimidate you and to avoid, you know, covering these things
To download everything from my phone, everything. So all my emails, it took them 6 hours to take all that information. And I still don't know where it is. I don't know who's received this information, what it's being used for, what my DNA is going to be used for. Is it going to be stored? Is it going to be, you know, used as some kind of data mining service in the future? I have no idea. There's been no responses from them since the interrogation.
Yeah. Well, Radhika and Vanessa, I mean, did you take any action, like in protest, like go to a political individual or anyone who could say, hey, you got to do something about this?
Well, I mean, I've just been so darn busy this past year, partly, of course, because of these things. Because Vanessa mentioned something which I should also mention, which is that, of course, when I came back, literally, like, as some of you know, part of the reason why I was interrogated, apart from going to the World Dyke Conference, is that I embarrassed the Canadian government, because we were asked, you know, in the past, we used to be able to just ask questions from the floor to President Putin. Valdai always closes with a big address by President Putin. That's like one of the big events on the foreign policy calendar in Russia. And so in the past, we used to just get up on the floor from the floor and ask questions. But lately, they have said, please submit questions. So I had submitted a question about the fact that, and this is an appropriate question to ask the president of the country that played such a big role in defeating Nazism, because the Canadian Parliament had stood up and applauded a Nazi on the grounds that he had been fighting the communists. And I just find it to this day astonishing that hundreds, how many MPs do we have? 400 and something?
338, I think.
Yeah, three, whatever. I think the senators were there too, but whatever. The point is that the entire parliament, hundreds of parliamentarians can stand up and applaud this guy without asking a very simple question. If he was fighting the Russians in World War II, who was he fighting with?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They never asked that question. I asked this question, and incidentally, I also asked a question about Boris Kagarlitsky. So I asked these two questions because Boris is a friend, although, you know, on the war, he has taken a position that I do not agree with, but I still think he's a great scholar and important intellectual. And, you know, anyway, I asked President Putin about this. And in fact, Boris was, as a result, released for a while. Yeah. Anyway, the point is that I asked this question, and of course, Putin began, you know, it took his time elaborating an answer, because, of course, as is his right as the leader of this country. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, he did this, and the meeting hadn't even ended. And my phone was bleeping with, you know, CBC wants to interview, blah, blah, etc. And I took the interview, and that told me, it taught me one lesson. Never do an interview unless they let you record it, because they so misrepresent what you've said. I mean, they just take little clips, you know, and they remove. And I would have loved to put a recording of that interview on my own website and said, please listen to this here. But anyway, so I just wanted to and then I got a barrage, you know, the local CBC people came and interviewed me and did the same hash job and so on. So all of that has happened. And I should mention just one quick other thing. And now I'm, you know, so I've just been so busy, and I have so much writing to do that I haven't bothered to do anything, although I have made notes. And I had for a while thought I would write a thing on sanctions, because there is something really, really problematic about sanctions too, because these sanctions are written in such a way that they will allow most businessmen to continue their operations with Russia and with Russian businesses. They are actually written in a way that they can be used to harass people like me, not to actually obstruct business between Canada and Russia, which is what their proclaimed goal is. So I was going to write an article about that. That didn't get done because of too many other things. But lately, there has been an article in the Hill Times about people who appear on RT and attend Valdai Club conferences. There is actually a handful of us in this country who fit that definition. And Dimitri Lascaris, who you'll know, and Alan and I, we certainly have written a joint letter to the Hill Times. We are told it's going to be published soon, so I hope they will publish it either this week or next. And I should also add that Vanessa's experience with, what is it, the venue being cancelled and finding a new secret venue each time. This happened when Dimitri was doing a tour, touring all over the country and reporting on his trip to Ukraine and to Crimea. To Russia and to Crimea. So anyway, I mean, these things are happening. And I would say, of course, now at Kevin's instigation, Kevin has taken the initiative, an excellent initiative, to start this Canadian Academics for Just Foreign Policy. So I'll let him talk about that. But this is the rubric under which we should fight.
Yeah. Yeah. And just to remind people, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and we're having a discussion three amazing academics and journalists who have been really breaking through new ground that the ground that the mainstream media and mainstream political forces try to cover over in a propagandistic way. Kevin McKay, the university has been such a a sanctuary in a sense. Certain perspectives like communism or LGBTQ in the past, they could be spoken here before anywhere else, really. This is where it started, as a sanctuary. But what's more, you have tenure, so it protects you, to explore new frontiers of thought, kind of unmolested. But now we're seeing where things are no longer safe. Talk about, going forward, where were these things that they're affecting a faculty and in students? Is there a noticeable change in the way they're studying and or behaving or working that you're noticing?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I wasn't around as an academic in the 60s, but from what I understand from folks who were, we've had waves of this kind of suppression, right? We've had, obviously sort of the McCarthyite era in the States. We had, our equivalent in Canada as well, where at different times academics have been suppressed. It always seems to be when the empire is waging major wars. I mean, when Canada was occupying Afghanistan, it was incredibly difficult to have any kind of discourse about Afghanistan within academia. So I think that's the suppression's always been there. But I think we see, I mean, recently, it seems to me anyway, that it's been given this new sort of unholy energy, right, by, the conflict in Palestine, the genocide there, by the Ukraine proxy war. There's a real... It's more blatant, I would say. It's more out in the open, in the sense that you have faculty members whose employment is being threatened. You have a lot of internal chilling, that I know Radhika, when we did our launch last week, spoke really, really eloquently about, just all the subtle ways in which, whether it's getting grants, whether it's getting publications, whether it's participating on committees, doing acts of service within the institution as professors are supposed to do. There's so many ways in which people can be marginalized, and they're doing it to students as well. So we had an amazing graduate student speaking at our launch last week, and it was a really heartbreaking story. She was talking about just all the ways in which she is being systematically marginalized, whether it's her thesis committee, whether it's constant investigations that the institution is conducting into her behavior. And the thing is, too, there's the weaponization of codes of conduct that we're seeing now across academia. And so we all have these kind of codes of conduct or civility policies or anti-harassment policies. And it sounds great on a certain level, if you're going to storm into someone's office and tell them off, well, we don't want that, right? But what they're being used to do is to suppress speech, to threaten, to intimidate and harass faculty who are speaking out against genocide, speaking out against proxy war, and even just speaking for peace. And this is what, to me, what is really interesting is just advocating for a peaceful foreign policy, advocating for things like international law and global cooperation. These things are making people a target now. And to sort of leave off my talk here, I just think that what I'd like people to understand is that so many of the things that as Canadians we like to think are sacrosanct, whether it's we live in a democratic society, we have a free and open media, we have academic institutions, like you said, Michael, that are these open spaces of knowledge exchange. All of these things are being severely eroded, seriously eroded. And I think that really what, if Canadians don't wake up pretty soon, that democracy is going to slip through our hands like grains of sand, because it really is getting that intense. And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to organize. I mean, everyone's already doing, the two other women on this conversation have been doing this for a lot longer than I have, but trying to organize, whether we're journalists or academics, I mean, we need to reassert these foundational values of a democratic society, that we have academic freedom, we have free speech, we have the freedom of dissent and association and whatnot. So I think that's the way forward, is we need to just keep organizing around these issues.
Yeah. Vanessa, I'm like listening to Kevin, I'm reminded of a saying. It was back in World War II, Martin Niemöller, first they came for the socialists, then they came for the trade unionists, then they came for the Jews, then they came for me. And I don't know. I don't think it's an exaggeration to say we're kind of on the same job. I mean, you're witnessing this, creeping levels of you know, fascism or something. But given your engagement, and you're right, like in the thick of things with your journalism and speaking out unreservedly, what do you think the kind of engagement where is this leading, do you think? What's happening around us, and what could we possibly do to reverse the trend?
That's a really interesting question, and I don't have all the answers, but I guess if I look at what frightens them most are these public talks, are these public conferences where people can come and hear you and ask questions and interact and meet you face to face. I mean, it's fantastic. We all have YouTube. Some of us don't, of course, because of censorship. But, you know, the internet is a great tool. But I don't think it's as big a threat as meeting people in person and talking to them about your experiences, because the internet creates a kind of gladiatorial environment in which people can just put forward their arguments and challenge your arguments in a very aggressive, non-constructive, counterintuitive way. But when you actually go to these public forums, and interestingly, as a group, which was called Media on Trial, we're restarting this, particularly in the UK, but then spreading outwards. And I think the very fact that these kind of events are being cancelled and being attacked, I mean, mine were actually under attack from the extremist elements that had come to Canada from Syria, and who objected to my speaking about my experience inside Syria, which was very different, of course, to the portrayal of events in Syria by the legacy media, the colonial media across the West. But I think when you can actually sit down face to face and have a panel of people who can present ideas and concepts and opinions in a very intelligent, constructive way, that destroys their narratives. And so for me, it's not allowing ourselves to be isolated, to make sure that we're creating groups of like-minded people all the time. Because, for example, I'm in Syria, you're in Canada, other people are in Russia. We're scattered. We don't have that enormous resource pool and complex, entire industrial complex of information manipulation. That the ruling elite and the oligarchs and the military industrial complex and the globalists have. We don't have that. But I think, and Russia is actually quite good at this. You mentioned Valdai, but there are many NGOs in Russia, for example, who are constantly establishing these kind of meeting places. And I think we need to start doing more of this, breaking out of that academic paradigm where you're in a minority, create the majority in another space, including academics or including journalists. And what I'd love to see, just one last thing, is this collaboration between like-minded academics and journalists, because that also has been eroded, and I think that's what I found incredibly valuable, because my experience, for example, on the ground, combined with an academic investigation into a certain event, is an invaluable combination. So I think that sort of collaboration between independent journalists and independent thinking academics is incredibly important also for the future.
Okay. Well, I'm out of time, so I've got to end it there. But I wanted to say, I wanted to have all of you together, because we should be coming together now and joining, and if we stick together, I'm hopeful that we'll arrive in a better place. So thanks to you all for this enlightening conversation. Many thanks to Kevin McKay, Radhika Desai, and Vanessa Beely. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.